Hello and welcome. You are listening to Moodily Matters, the podcast that recognizes that your mood matters. Every episode, we talk to a range of amazing guests with experience in some of the top organizations in the world, discussing work life at the crossroads of mood, well-being, and performance. Together, we aim to create better workplaces, one mood at a time. Let's get started with your host, Moodily founder, Erica First.
Hello, and thank you for being with me today. I am Erica First, your host of Moodily Matters. Today, I'm joined by my dear friend, Sam Campbell, the CEO and co-founder of Bleach Hair Color Products. Sam takes us on her journey from law school to heading up one of the coolest brands in beauty, and how she strongly believes that work should make you happy, and what she's doing to make sure that happens for her team. On to the episode.
Okay. Hi, Sam, and welcome. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Hello.
Why don't you start us off with telling us a little bit about your professional journey and what you've done that has led you to where you are today?
Great. So I'm Sam. I am the CEO of a hair color brand called Bleach London. We started Bleach 11 years ago now, so it's been a really, really long journey, lots of different lives of Bleach. I was really super young when we started, so there's been a really big learning curve, and I'm still definitely very much in the midst of that learning curve. I did a law degree, which is very far from the work that I'm doing today, but also I probably use some of the skills that I learned in my degree every single day. And then I did a little bit of work in media planning and buying straight out of uni, which is really great in terms of the skills I picked up in sort of like marketing, and particularly like digital marketing and direct response marketing. And then I went off to start my own business, which was originally, I was an agent for a couple of hair and makeup artists in the fashion and music business. And one of those was actually my now business partner, Alex. So she is a really high profile hairstylist in fashion. And so she really takes care of everything to do with the hair, the creative, the actual product, the brand, and my job was always everything else. So whether that's opening a salon or doing the contracts, doing the ops, the finance, hiring, things like that, that was always my side of everything. So I've always worked really, really closely with creatives, but I'm actually the opposite of that brain. I just seem to work well with them. So we have now got three salons in London, and we've got a salon in Hollywood. And we've got a product range of hair, colour, styling and care products, which actually launched in a license with Boots. So Boots did all the back end and we would just take a royalty. And now it's actually we do all the sort of supply chain end, and we sell to Boots and then a number of other retailers in the UK. And we're actually launching our product range into massive Walmart distribution in January to actually have a mass retailer in the States as well. So we've fundraised over £10 million in venture capital and institutional investors to fund our growth. And that's where we are today. So it's been all go.
Very exciting. And can you tell us a little bit about your work environment and some of the dynamics that you come up against every day?
Yeah, there's a lot. So we have our salons business, which is just a completely different, type of work than our products business, which is, you know, your finance team, your ops team, a social media team, they all sort of work together in the office, the same hours, and there's certain expectations around that sort of business compared with that type. So we have a few different types, and I think we struggle sometimes to know whether to integrate and treat everything the same, because otherwise there's a, well, why is it like that for them? Or why is it like that for them? But actually, I think fundamentally, things that are different need to be approached differently. So we're probably going to go full circle and just actually stop trying to treat everything the same, because it kind of doesn't really work. So we've got some really, really young team members, like it's their first jobs, particularly in the salons. And there's almost a vulnerability to some of the team members. And I think that's been exacerbated a bit with COVID. So, you know, the hairdressers, it's actually a contact job. So when those salons opened, they were actually having to do people's hair in the middle of COVID when everybody else was social distancing. So I feel like that level of vulnerability in the salons has increased quite a lot, and their progression has been on pause for nearly 2 years, which is a long, long time in the early stages of your career for your progression to just be completely stopped. So I think in terms of the way that I'm learning about working with such different, managing such a diverse group of people, I think the main thing I'm learning is to actually adapt, and there just cannot be a one size fits all in terms of how to approach a dynamic, or how to approach this, because it's one company and it is Bleach, so it should be like that. And on the flip side, I've got members of the team who are like 20 years older than me, and I've got a lifetime of experience in something I know absolutely nothing about. So that's also a really difficult dynamic to juggle, that I find it difficult to juggle as well. And I think the point is you can't possibly get it right every time.
Right.
And you can't say, you know, this is how I'm going to approach a situation. I'd obviously like to come out of all conversations and they've been positive and productive. And if I come out and they haven't been those things, then I'll just look at myself and think, I'm going to have to change that and do that differently next time, because I'd never learn that about somebody and then go back and just keep doing it at the same time and having a negative experience. So I just look at how I handle things and just try and just adapt. Just adapting, I think, is the main thing.
Do you think it's harder to deal with, because you're kind of like in the middle, you sort of play mom to some and the student to others.
Yeah.
So which of those two roles do you find more challenging?
I find it more challenging to manage someone when they're doing when they've done something wrong, or to pull them up on something, because everyone is working so hard. We're in this like really, really high growth environment, which is basically constantly chasing your tail and almost constantly under-resourced. So the dynamic is always that everybody is just doing their best. And I think that's probably the thing that I struggle with the most, is having performance conversations and keeping them really positive, bearing in mind that that person's probably just completely worked their ass off.
Right.
So I find the supporting part really easy, and nurturing and mentoring and all of those things. But I do find it really difficult to, again, particularly if it's someone really, really, really over experienced and a lot more experienced than me, a lot cleverer than me. Like they always say, hire people who are cleverer than you. So I find managing that really difficult dynamic.
Okay. And what do you think are the things that cause you the most stress in your day? You said having those difficult conversations with someone who you want to almost like be friends with, you know, you want to have a pleasant, you want to like each other, but you also have to grow them. Outside of that, what are some of the other stressors that you have to deal with?
So as I said, that burnout one is probably the biggest one. So people working really, really hard in such a fast-paced environment, we're never going to just have the exact right amount of people to do what we're trying to execute this year and next, do all the work in preparation for next year, but we haven't got the team in place for next year yet. That is really, really rife in a startup environment, and it's really hard to even solve, like when we're thinking about different like well-being initiatives and things like that. The pace in a startup is something that you just actually can't change, and that is just the business when it's in growth. So just trying to make sure that there's not a second of time is wasted, or you're not asking anybody for a second of something that they don't need to be doing. And I think that's got to come from a really senior management place. Another thing that is I find the team struggle with is the agility that's required in that exact same environment. So we can be working to a plan, but if we go back to a few years ago where it was like me and Alex and a couple of people, like if an opportunity came up, we would just put that down and we would just crack on with the new thing that came in. And it would be the opportunities are too good to miss, and we just got to do it and we've just got to get it done. And that can make certain personality types, and probably most personality types, feel quite unsafe in their role because they're on a path, they're working to a plan, they've put so much work into a plan, and to then have something come in that they're told is maybe even more important or something like that, that pivoting is already an enormous challenge for most people. And that's kind of always been at play in the startup environment. But with COVID, that had to happen every couple of months because you had to pick your plan up and rip it up and put it in the bin and literally write a new plan. And then you would think it was a 2-month plan. And then 2 months later, you'd have to do another one and that wouldn't work, but something else would be working. And I think probably to go back to normal levels of startup agility, everybody's going to be a bit more of a dab hand at it because everybody was sort of forced to do it. And it was, you know, the pandemic's fault. It wasn't necessarily going to be seen to have been me personally asking people to do that. So I think everyone's had a bit of a hard lesson in that, which is a good thing, but it definitely makes people feel unsafe and definitely contributes to the burnout problem. So I think as we grow, it needs to be, that's a great opportunity, but at what cost? Rather than looking at the opportunity in isolation. And then the third thing in terms of like the primary concerns that we have to deal with is inclusivity, which again goes back to how we have such a diverse group of people who work for us, and just really making people feel like they belong at work. And it all just lends into each other, really. But there can definitely be more unconscious biases at play, or people maybe even more blatantly have been wronged. But actually, it's actually really, really rare for somebody to make a formal complaint. But I can know that these things have happened, or I can be told that these things have happened. So I think for us, it's always really important to address things in whatever way we possibly can, proactively, even completely in the absence of a formal complaint. And doing those sorts of things can just mean a lot of learning and improving and listening. And it's just a massive work in progress. It takes up a lot of senior management time, which is a good thing. And I actually think the pandemic has done a lot of good things in terms of the way that CEOs and very, very senior management teams are actually giving a lot of airtime to people initiatives and well-being initiatives, and that can only be a really positive thing. And it's definitely happening at Bleach more than it ever has. So yeah, they're probably the three key things: burnout, agility, and inclusivity, I would say.
Okay, and I'm trying to figure out where to go next with this, because that's like super. No, because it's super interesting. There's like the Sam, the manager, these are the organizational challenges and stressors that we deal with. And it's interesting to hear also how high people are on there. It's also really interesting to hear that, because you guys are a very creative business, and in theory, you know, less structured or less organized, like a P&G might be. And yet it's interesting to hear that even in a very creative environment, not having a plan can throw people off and make them uncomfortable. But let's talk about you personally, if I'm allowed. Yeah. So we know what Sam the manager's stressed about. What stresses Sam the person?
So I put everything down to resilience, and because a problem of one size one day will be a completely different size another day. That's how I like legitimately feel. I can cope with such an enormous problem really easily one day, and then the tiniest thing will completely consume and overwhelm me another day. And that's obviously all the external factors that just come into each person's resilience. So your health and your diet, whether I got drunk last night, whether I've had an argument with somebody else, whether something else at work is stressing me out. If everything else is sort of simmering away, bubbling away really nicely, then I honestly can handle enormous problems really, really, really well. And I my default is quite a strong person. So it's just where that strength has been chipped away at. And there's, if that's happened, then nothing can help me basically. And that's how I look at everything. And that means sort of isolating the problem, because it's not really about that, or it's not really about anything. It's just about how I am in terms of how I'm capable, my tools I've got to deal with that day.
Right. But so if I'm understanding you correctly, what you're saying is it's not actually the thing, it's how you're feeling in that day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it might not even realize I'm feeling that way. Right. I might think that I'm fine, and then I'll realize I'm completely spiraling over something really quite small. If I try and figure out what it is, it's often just that my resilience is down for other reasons, or it's a combination of things. And I think that owning a business, being the CEO of a business, having the book really end with you, having no boundaries with work, like all of these things, like it's just a lot at all times. It's a really high stress way to live, and it's a really high stress environment. So taking all that into account, I think I do handle it really, really well, because that is a lot for one person to have. It's just really random. I'll just randomly not be able to handle something really small.
Well, it's quite normal. I mean, especially because that's kind of the whole premise of what I do, is that if you're not in the right mood, It's never the what, it's how you feel you're able to respond to it. And in science, they call it self-efficacy. So if you feel that your self-efficacy is low that day, like you don't have the resources that you need to fight it back, then it's going to overwhelm you.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you guys have these salons, and there's lots of different characters that work in the salon area. How do you maintain good moods in the workplace, like to try and keep them all in a good place? Because I imagine if one is off and in sort of a terrible mood, it can kind of cast a halo on the rest of the place.
We spend a lot of effort trying to work this through, because particularly in salons, it one person can, you're right, drag the whole team down. And it hasn't been any more sort of like rife than it has been in the last sort of year or so, because they were furloughed, they were off work, as I sort of said about their progression being on pause. They've got some of course got really severe health anxiety. We actually tried to say, you know, we're going to make sure you've got a really, really secure role and actually repurpose you across the business, even if the salons are closed, to sort of keep working. And it was before in the UK we got this thing called furlough. So the government paid people's wages if their business was closed. It was before they announced they would do that. We were like, we'll sort of repurpose everybody. And it was seen as a real positive step, but hairdressing is a real vocation, and actually asking them to work on customer service or help in any other ways. Like there was a lot of online, like doing consultations online and social media content and things like that. And actually that just made them deeply unhappy as well. And being furloughed made them deeply unhappy. And I think, you know, for a lot of people, it's their dream job, which is great, because work, your job should make you happy. Like I believe that achieving at work is actually the root of most people's happiness. You know, it's not that, you know, work's a drag and I want to stay at home and do nothing all day. Like, no one really wants that.
You might want to talk to my daughter. She's not.
I'm talking about people the age of your daughter who are trying to think about how people perceive work to be. I think most people at work at Bleach are working there because in theory it is them achieving their dreams. And realistically it should be making them happy. So if somebody isn't happy, it's probably to do with, you know, they've decided they don't want to do the job anymore, or there isn't a clear plan of how they're going to get to a point where, you know, they're going to be able to buy that house that they want to buy. So, you know, we can put lots of like wellbeing initiatives in place. We try and help financially. We have like private medical insurance. We do a tenancy deposit loan. We pay for therapy for all of the staff. So there is lots of little things that you can do, but realistically, I just believe work should make you happy and no problem is insurmountable. It's just about figuring out what it is that's making you feel rubbish.
Right. Now, and of course, obviously the pandemic is an odd parenthesis in everybody's chapter. Yeah. Now you guys are back open and back in business normally, correct?
Yeah.
And have you kept like most of your team? Is everybody back and operational? Were some people like, did they reevaluate what they wanted to do and go do something else, or?
Yeah, so a few people have left from the salons business. There was a real sense of unhappiness in a few members of that team. And there was a lot of one-to-ones, like, what can we do? What do you need? What's the feedback? Like, directly with me. And so we've sort of tried everything we can. And then there's just still a couple of team members who just wanted to leave. And I think there's just been so much change that just coming back and cracking on as if nothing happened, it was really, really difficult for a few people. Mm. But yeah, the vast majority, everybody's back. We've put in a few more assistants and team leaders and a bit more resource. We're trying to accelerate people's progression, whereas it would be quite strict before, like, you know, the assistants had to sort of be completely ticked off before they could start doing clients. Whereas now we've got a couple of assistants who are sort of half still assistants and then half doing certain clients, just because we really need to help people make up for what they lost while those salons were closed.
Okay, so you guys really focus on job, like creating well-being for people through the idea of stability and job design, making sure they're happy doing what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, so the immediate thought when the pandemic happened and the salons went after close was to just say, we're going to repurpose you across the business. Like, you're not going to lose your job. And that was how we felt was the best thing that we could possibly say to anyone to reassure them. And then actually, because the government were covering their wages, then we probably repurposed them for too long.
Right.
But it almost became a negative thing. But, you know, I think as well, the thing with the pandemic is, you know, no one knew what they were doing. Everybody was just trying to do their best and trying to put people in health first. And I think we can really like comfortably say that we definitely did that. So
that's good. What do you think, like what's a wellness intervention that you think in the UK that you'll be seeing more of in the future?
So like I sort of said earlier, the pandemic's done a few really positive things. And I think one of the key ones for me is flexibility. And I can remember when I was in employment and I had a lot of self-employed friends, and just that, I mean, I guess at that age, it was all about, you know, going out, and they could go out on a Sunday and then not do anything on a Monday, but work on a Saturday. And that always really, really fascinated me, that some people are just have complete autonomy. And of course, they obviously don't, because they've got to do their work.
We all work for someone.
Exactly. But I think the flexibility that is becoming really, really commonplace, even in really, really big corporations now, I just think it's amazing. Like, people being able to choose where they work best and how they work best. It's really quite new and it's really, really exciting. And, you know, we have it. And I guess that is something that the hairdressers aren't being able to enjoy the benefit of. Again, so they're getting another sort of duff deal there. You know, they can do their clients whenever they want, and we actually aren't particularly rigid about that. So perhaps there's a bit more room around how that works. But in the office, then there's definitely so much more understanding. I mean, I think I'm even guilty of years ago assuming that if someone was going to work from home, like, they were going to skive off. And actually, that's just gone. Like, nobody thinks that anymore. Everybody knows that everybody's just sat at home trying to do their best and continuing on, you know, their own personal ambitions of achieving their dreams. And like I said, sat around at home doing nothing isn't going to make anybody happy ultimately. So we don't have a problem with that. And I think that's what most businesses are finding as well. So it's great for mums, it's great for parents. And I think it's just great for mental health to just not feel shackled to a desk at the exact same time every single day, no matter what else is going on in your life. I think that getting out of that behavior is just great.
Which is so interesting, because on one hand, we're trying to create stability for them, and yet that stability comes through an increased sense of freedom.
That is very ironic. But what a wonderful world where you get both.
Yes, upside down. But one of the things that I noticed, because I've done a lot of research into, you know, what the big corporations think of their employees staying home, and there is, in some companies, there is still that stigma of, no, the ones in the office are working more, when actually the statistics show that that's actually the opposite, that they work better from home.
I am that person. If I'm at home, I get 10 times more work done than when I'm in the office. And being in the office and engaging with the rest of the team and investing in those relationships, that's that has to be done, but I'm not going to get as much actual work done that day. Right. So I think, and I would assume that's really similar for most people.
So it's almost like creating, like you work from home and then you intentionally create connection moments.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
I haven't figured it out yet.
We'll come back and do a round two when you've cracked it.
I've solved everything.
You're like, done, check. Future of work, next. No, but I think the thing that's really interesting about how you talk about your staff and the people that work with you is that there seems to me to be an incredible amount of trust coming from the upper management towards the employees. Because when you talk to people in large organizations, there can be a high level of, and it's interesting because in the data, trust as an aspect in how employees evaluated their companies doesn't appear in the research until after the pandemic, because now people are complaining that they don't feel trusted by their employers. And that makes them want to work less because it's like, well, if you're already accusing me of the crime, I might as well do it.
Yeah.
But it sounds like what I find so refreshing also coming from you is that there's an incredible sense that these people are driven by autonomy, self-autonomy, and they're going to work hard because they want to work hard. And you sort of create an environment where that's possible.
Yeah. And I think that I think we've obviously been privileged enough to recruit a team of people where they are those people, and that's great. Like, lucky me that I get to have a team of people that I can trust are that way inclined. But that's not to say that they don't have off days, off weeks, off months. But the values are still there. And if there's something wrong, there's something wrong. It's as I said, it's like an off day, because ordinarily, I think most people can be completely trusted to it. And I think if that isn't there, it could be because it's true, but it could also just show a real detachment from reality. So in the bigger corporations, there is inherently going to be like less awareness of how hard everybody's working because there's just too many people, you know. Right. So someone from, if I think about one of our board directors, they could make a comment that said, oh, isn't everyone back in the office yet? Are you sure they're not doing any work? Because they're not in the day-to-day and they don't know them and they're completely detached from reality. I can wholeheartedly say it doesn't matter whether they're in the office or not, they're working their ass off, because I know they are, and they're still at that size. So I think it's something to be conscious of as you grow, that the decision makers don't become too detached, because that's going to lose all those really wonderful values.
Yeah, that's interesting that the distrust comes from distance.
Yeah, it does.
And disconnect. That's very interesting. Okay, so let's do the last question for you. So what are three pieces of advice that you would give a young person entering into the workforce today?
Going back to what I said, you should find your happiness at work. It's all well and easy to say you should. Obviously, some people don't, and that it's going to take a bit of finding. But if you're positive about your work and you're actually working hard and achieving and showing up, I think that drives happiness. It does for me anyway. And where you're having a bit of a rubbish few months where you know you're not showing up and you know that you're not doing your best, that is what I think breeds. I think especially as you're going through your first few jobs, I think that's what really breeds unhappiness and anxiety, and it can eat away at you that you're not doing your best. And I just think as long as you're doing your best, I think that you'll succeed and ultimately achieving your career goals is just one of the top contributors to your overall happiness for your entire life. So I don't know if that's probably might be putting too much pressure on younger people, but I think just find the thing that makes you happy and work really hard at it.
Mm. No, it's good. I mean, I think that the coming from a different generation myself, we were very much take the job, pay your dues, event, follow the path, and hope, you know, keep your fingers crossed that like you get in, if you follow all the boxes, you get into the right place. Obviously, I started very late the whole entrepreneurial path. You went straight into it. But what I find in the younger generations now is a very conscious awareness of this is my life and my time, and they are the same thing. And so if I'm going to invest my life energy into you, there better be something good in it for me, which of course, you know, as someone who's ancient, that goes against everything that I've learned.
the for you and for me thing comes up a lot because So I was obviously an employee before. So then it was like, oh, I'm not working for myself. But obviously everyone is working for themselves or they wouldn't be doing it. There's, you know, they are working for me, but they're not working for me. And I think that's where sometimes I think I can get triggered sometimes because there was probably 6 or 7 years where I didn't even get paid. And so there's always this thought that the business owner is just ultimately massively profiteering off your work. And when actually I was always a bit like, well, I don't seem to be getting anything out of this. Now things are different and it's going really, really well. Then I think I need to be more like respect that a little bit more, that people will always feel like they're working for me, even though they're not. And I always find that dynamic really, really interesting because I also have other business partners and shareholders and things like that. And it's like, it's for all of us. I work for the entity. You work for the entity. Yes, I helped create the entity. You know, we all need to do what the entity needs to stick to the plan, stick to, you know, be able to pay everyone's wages and to ultimately exist. And it's my job to make sure as the CEO, to make sure that everybody is doing what they need to do for that business. And so the working for the business or working for me thing, I always struggle with a little bit as well. But there's no getting away from it. They're always gonna, the employees are always going to feel like it. There's a little bit of that extra. It's for me. So,
right. Although it's interesting because when you talk about an entity, right? And so the entity can be the company. And usually, what I'm finding in younger companies, startups, et cetera, is that the entity is very much attached to an ideal, a vision, a mission, so that when they do invest their time, it's not, it's no longer a game of like, I want to succeed and get here and make this much amount of money and do this and do that. Yeah. But it's like, I'm working towards creating something bigger than me.
Yeah. And we took out any mention of commercial goals in any vision or mission or strategy or anything like that. So we don't want to say, oh, we want to be £100 million hair brand. Like, we would never say that. It has to be, right. We want to be the best hair brand, or we want to be the coolest hair brand, or we want to be the most empowering hair brand. And I think that sort of commercially driven mission is quite vulgar and is definitely not going to set the right tone for, it's never going to work nicely with the people policies, basically. So we're really careful as well.
That's super interesting. And I'm a great place to end here. So I am going to thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of Moodily Matters. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We really appreciate that effort, and we'll catch you in the next episode of Moodily Matters. Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of Moodily Matters. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We really appreciate that effort, and we'll catch you in the next episode of Moodily Matters.